Short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Matthew Smith, producer of Vermont Edition, and I wanted to say thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Earlier today, the U.S. House of Representatives voted to transmit two articles of impeachment against President Donald Trump to the Senate. A trial on the two articles, one for abuse of power, another for obstruction of Congress, is expected to begin as early as Tuesday. This entire impeachment saga kicked off in August when an anonymous whistleblower filed a complaint with the Inspector General for the U.S. intelligence community. The complaint was about a July phone call between President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. That complaint was judged a, quote, urgent concern, which triggered a House and Senate notification. And that led to meetings, hearings, a formal impeachment inquiry in the House, and soon a trial in the Senate. Despite protections in our laws for whistleblowers, President Trump has made no secret he would like to see this particular whistleblower unmasked.
But basically, that person never saw the report, never saw the call, meaning never saw the call, heard something, and decided that he or she, whoever the hell it is, sort of like almost a spy. I want to know who's the person that gave the whistleblower, who's the person that gave the whistleblower the information, because that's close to a spy. You know what we used to do in the old days when we were smart, right, with spies and treason, right? We used to handle it a little differently than we do now.
That tape, originally obtained by the Los Angeles Times, was of the president speaking at a closed-door event for staff and families of the U.S. delegation of the U.S. mission to the United Nations in late September. Students of history should find nothing surprising in the fact that there's backlash from those in power against a whistleblower. That's almost as old as the tradition of blowing the whistle in the first place. Today, we're going to listen back to a conversation from September with Allison Stanger, a professor of international politics and economics. She's on leave from Middlebury College this year. She's a senior fellow at Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. And we talked about her latest book, Whistleblowers, Honesty in America, From Washington to Trump. Now, remember, this was in September. So as I welcomed her to the show, I couldn't resist asking how she managed to have such incredible timing for her new book.
Good to talk to you, Jane.
How in the world did you time this book to come out when it did?
Deep state conspiracy.
Yeah, really. I'm suspicious.
Yeah. No, it's an incredible coincidence, but it's the result of 7 years of work and a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. They went through five full manuscript iterations, hundreds of pages on the floor. So it is totally a very bizarre coincidence, but wonderful to be able to provide some context for the crazy events that are unfolding before us.
Well, you must have thought it timely and something that people would be interested to read and know about to begin with. I mean, we've had recent issues where there have been questions about who is a whistleblower, what do we call a whistleblower, and what protections should they have or not have. I mean, just thinking about Julian Assange and Edward Snowden, for example. So it's not like there's been a dearth of whistleblowing in recent history either.
No, and it goes throughout U.S. history. But I really first got interested in the topic because of my last book, One Nation Under Contract, which was a study of the privatization of American national security. I got super interested in these contractors popping up all over the world and the way they were replacing, you know, ordinary government employees. And that whole privatization really blurs the line between business and government and forces us to place a lot of trust in our elites that they're going to do the right thing for the American people rather than for themselves and their own economic interests. So after writing that book, I thought, we're really trusting people to do the right thing when you know, they can benefit themselves without anybody knowing. So how do we keep our elites honest? And that's what led me to whistleblowers. Because as you've pointed out, throughout American history, that's exactly what they do.
Well, and you just mentioned that there were hundreds of pages that got thrown into the wastebasket, the digital wastebasket. And you say that in the introduction that actually you had written something like 300 pages worth of information about corporate whistleblowers, which you ditched. I mean, that's longer than the whole book itself. And then you're focusing on government whistleblowers because, you know, because there's a lot just to tackle with that.
Exactly.
And especially, as you said, now that so many people working for the government don't actually work for the government. They're contractors. So it really has blurred that line.
Yes, and it totally contributes to the sort of corruption we're seeing now at very high levels, both in our government and in the corporate world. So it's funny. I mean, the Snowden thing also sent me back to square one because I had a complete draft of the manuscript, and then that controversy broke, and I thought, oh, I better understand that. Then you try to understand it. It's so complex. It grew and grew and grew, and then I realized that was another book. So I'll be working on some of the issues that relate to that in my next book. So it was an arduous process to get to the point where it was the way I wanted it to be.
Well, I know a lot of listeners have questions and certainly have been thinking about whistleblowers and whistleblowing and whether it's patriotism or treason or something in between, depending on who's doing it and for what purpose. So we're going to talk about that. And listeners, if you have a question for Alison Stanger or if you want to share a thought, you're welcome to. You can go to vpr.org and click on today's Vermont edition, or you can give us a call. Our number is 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And Professor Stanger, as you might imagine, people have been commenting on the VPR Facebook page. Caleb says, whistleblowers should be praised. And yes, Snowden was right and should be back home. James says, selling secrets to another government is treason. Exposing government corruption, abuse, and wrongdoing is patriotism. Rich says, all presidents must be held accountable for the things they have done, be they good or bad. And Keith says, whistleblowers are true patriots and deserve to be protected at all costs. But on the flip side, Scott says, not this Trump whistleblower. This is a partisan hit job on our president. Prosecute the whistleblower. And Danny just says, I think I'm sick of politics.
So I'm with you, Danny.
Yeah, I mean, that's a nonpartisan statement if ever there was one. Yeah. So before we get into some of the actual incidents that you look at in the book and people that sort of illustrate what you've been talking about, one of the things that you say is that we need to, in order to define what whistleblowing is, strip the definition of partisan leanings. And it struck me as even the definition or the meaning of what it is to blow the whistle up for debate and partisan difference.
Yeah, that I really spent a lot of time on that in the book to get the definition rooted in the rule of law, stripped of any political content. So whistleblowers reveal misconduct that elites would like to keep secret. And we have laws that protect whistleblowers. So it's really not a partisan issue. It's an American issue and an important part of keeping democracy vibrant and alive. I'll leave it at that.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because you say that, and I'll quote you here, you say, whistleblowers betray their organization or its leaders in the service of truth. Their motives for doing so are irrelevant.
Mm-hmm. That's a really important point given the current circumstances, because I think what you see is a lot of back and forth and partisan mudslinging, and we really need to stay focused on the content of the complaint itself. Whistleblowing has nothing to do, the person's motives are irrelevant. If you look at Deep Throat, for example, who exposed the whole Watergate abuse of power on the part of President Nixon, he did not have pure motives in giving that information to Bob Woodward. He actually was gunning for the position of FBI director, and those revelations hurt his rival. But that is simply irrelevant because it's what he revealed that should be the focus of our attention. And that's the case with this whistleblower complaint today, which really indicates a cover-up, which has since not become a cover-up because the president has said, oh, that's fine, that behavior is fine. But they were trying to keep the information secret. It's really a cover-up of both a national security threat and a threat to democracy, because it's all related to foreign electoral interference to help the Trump campaign in the next election. It's pretty obvious that we want Americans to elect our officials and not foreigners. So the content of the complaint is really what needs to be focused on. And one other whistleblower has come forward. We're going to see many more whistleblowers in the weeks ahead, and people willing to speak out and corroborate the information inside the complaint.
I mean, it's interesting. You do write about some whistleblowers throughout American history who seem to have decided that they needed to come forward because of something that they felt was just a legal, legally wrong, but also morally wrong, that they just felt that their more moral conscience said they had to come forward. And I think Bunny Greenhouse, who came forward about issues with Halliburton, might be one of those, and some mm-hmm. others. But you go back as far as Boss Tweed and Jimmy O'Brien, who took down Boss Tweed in I think it was 1870, mm-hmm. who did so because of jealousy, because he was jealous, not because he had some moral objection. And I think it's probably hard for many Americans to separate the reason that somebody comes forward with the information that is then revealed. Because presumably, for many of these people, if they weren't jealous, if they weren't gunning for the job, if they weren't partisan, they wouldn't come forward. And we only get that information, illegal as it might have been, because they had this ulterior motive.
Yeah, I think it's really important to put aside the question of motives and look at actually what is being revealed. And that's hard to do, because you're right that so many whistleblowers have mixed motives. But there are also a lot of whistleblowers, as I point out in the book, that are absolutely admirable. And you see this time and time again, too, that they'll say, you'll ask them why they did it, and they'll just say, I thought it was wrong. You know, I had no choice but to speak out. And so those sorts of acts of courage are also peppered among the stories and worthy of our attention.
Professor Stenger, you say that whistleblowing and the protection for whistleblowers, although there's a lot of holes in that protection, that is almost as old as the Republic itself. So why did early American leaders believe that putting in place this standard that somebody can call out misconduct and be protected for it was important to American democracy?
Yeah, I think it's really instructive to look at the person who was responsible for America's first whistleblower protection law, not just the first in the United States, but the first in the world. And that's a man by the name of Essex Hopkins, who was the first Commodore of the United States Navy. And Hopkins was removed from his post as Commander-in-Chief of the Navy for abusing his public office for private gain. He also tortured British prisoners of war. But what I show in the book through doing archival research is the main reason he was removed from power is he was defying Congress. General Washington in Congress would tell him to send the Navy to Chesapeake Bay to engage the British in the Revolutionary War, and Hopkins would instead take the ships to the Bahamas in a way that served his commercial interests, which as a Rhode Islander, a member of Rhode Island's social elite, were very much bound up in the slave trade. So here, the first whistleblower protection law in the United States results from a man who was pursuing his own economic interests at the expense of the American people, at the expense of the war effort. And Congress believed so strongly that this was an important part of American democracy that they paid the whistleblowers legal fees, they got them out of jail, and they also legislated to make sure that all the documents were available to the public, which is the only reason we can tell the story today. So I think that story is really illuminating as far as how important this is to the founders' conception of proper governance. We don't want our public officials to be pursuing their own interests. We want them to put those completely aside and serve the American people. And that's the reason why typically most elected officials divest themselves from anything that might suggest a conflict of interest. Obviously, we have something very different today with President Trump.
Well, I mean, you also say, though, that the early leaders of the United States, of the newly born United States, were worried that these people who were acting in their own best interests, or if they went unpunished for that, that it could undermine the new republic, that, you know, this was such a new country that we really needed these protections to make sure that the early republic could be supported and that constituents had faith in the government and, you know, that this could actually keep moving forward, not just because they thought it was right, but because they thought the strength of the union depended on it.
Absolutely. And there was this whole idea of, you know, the virtuous public servant who really can't be involved in benefiting from public office, because it just by definition suggests that they're not serving the American people. And the founders really had this conception of virtue that really stems back to the Romans that they were pretty adamant about. That obviously we have some changes in the way we view virtue today in this country, but it's definitely embedded in the system we've inherited.
Let's go to Bob, who's calling in from Rutland. Bob, hi. You're on the air with Allison Stanger.
Yes. I was going to say, just bring things more local to Vermont. With Vermont establishing an ethics commission, what kind of whistleblower protections are there here in the state?
Bob, thanks for the question. Professor Stanger, do you know about state-level protections for whistleblowers versus what the federal protections are?
I actually don't, and that's a really great question, and I haven't studied it, but it's obviously something that would be important to have in state government as well as in federal government. But I'm not familiar. I didn't write about state laws in my book. I do know that whistleblower protection is very important in all sorts of organizations. Obviously, the ideal is you want someone to report up within the organization and have the leadership deal with the complaint rather than it spilling out into the public arena. If you have those robust protections backed up by law, it's better for everybody. So Vermont, this is something to look into.
What are the federal protections for whistleblowers? I mean, what protection is somebody who comes forward to come clean about abuse or illegality supposed to have?
Well, it's really interesting because all federal government employees have whistleblower protection through the Whistleblower Protection Enhancement Act of 1989 and 2012. But national security employees are explicitly excluded from that legislation. In other words, all government employees have the protection, but not national security employees. And so there's some other legislation that gives a modicum of protection to people bringing forward complaints in the intelligence community. You have an executive order issued by President Obama that helped stand up the process that led to this whistleblower complaint coming forward. But someone like Edward Snowden doesn't really have full statutory protection, which is part of the reason why he did not complain through internal channels.
Well, doesn't someone like Edward Snowden or others who are not actually, whether they're national security staffers or not, if they're contractors, they also don't have the same protection, right? If they're working for a private company?
That's right. And that was the additional wrinkle with Snowden, because at the time of the Snowden heist, he was actually a contractor. And that executive order from Obama, it's almost impossible to read, but it's pretty clear that contractors don't have the same protection as government employees, which takes us back to this earlier issue I was talking about, which is if the business of government has become business and so much of government work is in private hands, you've got a real gray area where a lot of abuse can take place. I just cite one example. The whole Abu Ghraib scandal was very much indicative of this, where there were contractors and military personnel involved. The military men and women were punished. The contractors, to this day, are involved in lawsuits.
You also write that one of the reasons why whistleblowers may often go to the press, whether they're contractors or national security staffers or otherwise, is because they know that journalists have the protection of the First Amendment and may have more protection in keeping their sources secret than the whistleblowers themselves have with the federal government.
That's right. And there's a real intimate connection between the First Amendment and whistleblowing that you can see pretty clearly there. But, you know, that's where the United States is distinctive with the First Amendment, because with the Snowden case, you had some really interesting things taking place that I write about in the book, where the Guardian is able to publish things in the United States protected by the First Amendment that are forbidden to be published by the Official Secrets Act in the UK. So you actually have the police storming the Guardian's offices in London and smashing hard drives because this violates the Official Secrets Act. So the First Amendment does really give robust protections to freedom of the speech, freedom of the press, and by extension, whistleblower protections are very much bound up with the First Amendment.
Today, we're listening back to a conversation from September with Allison Stanger, a professor on leave from Middlebury College. She had just released a new book on whistleblowers in America, a book with all the more relevance amid a whistleblower's complaint being the impetus for what has become an impeachment inquiry against President Donald Trump, and now an impeachment trial. In a minute, we're going to hear about how, despite our laws being designed to protect whistleblowers, these whistleblowers rarely avoid punishment for speaking out. But first, we took a call from Peggy in Williston, who shared her own experience of being a whistleblower.
Yes, good morning. I'm going to try and make this as short as I can because I don't want to take up your time. I'm a veterinarian, and I work for USDA as a veterinary medical officer. My boss stole over $100,000 from the travel voucher fund. The secretary was frightened that she would get blamed, so she gave me all the paperwork. I took it to the regional director in Albany and showed him the paperwork, and he said, if you do anything about this, we'll file a grievance against you. And I said, what for? I haven't done anything. He said, well, we'll find something. So I came back to Williston, to Burlington, and I got a hold of Senator Leahy, gave him the information, and within 4 months, my boss was gone, the regional director was gone, and the head of veterinary services, USDA, was gone. Meanwhile, they had fabricated my fitness report was like you wouldn't believe. It was very negative. I couldn't follow orders, you know, all this stuff. They said I had stolen drugs. And eventually they abolished my job. So I sued them. Bill Bransford from Washington, D.C. was my attorney. We got through the first hearing. And he said, well, unfortunately, you're going to have to go through EEOC and the Special Counsel of the Merit System Protection Board. By the time you get through with this, he said, you're probably going to, it's going to cost you around $100,000. And I said, well, Bill, I've been thinking of going to law school. Bill says, take your money and go to law school. So I did.
Huh. Yeah, so, Peggy, wow. you consider yourself a whistleblower.
She is.
Oh, God, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Boss who stole over $100,000. But what they did to me was, there's no government protection there. I feel sorry for these two whistleblowers. And you know what's interesting is this was back in 1984 when it happened to me. So now I realize the law has changed. But there is a veterinarian in Kansas who I'm in contact with that's going through identically what I went through back in 1984. And this is 2018, 19.
Wow, Peggy, this is, I'm so, it's so interesting to hear your own personal example of this and to hear how you suffered for coming forward. And Allison Stanger, I mean, you say in the book, almost to a person, every whistleblower or every high-profile whistleblower suffers. And Peggy says she did, and she's worried about the whistleblowers who have come forward to talk about these conversations between President Trump and the Ukrainian president.
Well, Peggy's story is just great because it really does, it is unfortunately the typical story and pattern for a whistleblower. I call it the paradox of whistleblowing in America in the book, because in theory, you know, I've just told you it's part of Americans' DNA, we really do celebrate the whistleblower, the independent spirit, speaking truth to power. That's the reason why both Democrats and Republicans in the Senate turned over the complaint and unanimously agreed to do so. But when it comes to practice, it's another matter entirely, and your story describes that completely and resonates with so many others before you. So we should be grateful to this whistleblower for coming forward. We should do what we can to see that they're protected, but it's, we also need to realize it's just human nature to want to retaliate against the person, the one person who says, you know, this isn't right. The status quo is not acceptable. People don't want to hear that. And they behave accordingly, as Peggy's story illustrates. So thank you for your service, Peggy.
You also talk about Dan Meyer, who actually worked for the government to protect whistleblowers, wound up being a whistleblower himself, and then was essentially fired for doing so. And the whistleblower in the situation in Abu Ghraib, where prisoners were being abused, Joseph Darby, mm-hmm. who it sounds like still can't go home to his home community. He's been ostracized and really cannot return to his normal life, perhaps ever.
Yes, and hopefully we'll see a change in public attitudes as the result of current events, because each of these people you mentioned have performed a vital public service, and instead of being appreciated, their lives are being destroyed or have been destroyed, and it shouldn't be that way.
Let's hear from Michael, also calling in from Williston. Hi, Michael. Go right ahead.
Hi. Yes. I had a top secret SCI clearance many years ago in the Air Force, and I wanted to address the kind of environment that lifetime people have in those kinds of jobs. I mean, ultimately, it's a very heady environment to start with because you feel like you're totally in the know about everything, and it's very difficult if you have for objections to go up the chain of command. So there's kind of a good old boys understanding that we're doing the right thing for the country. We know more than anybody else, and we have the right to do the right thing. And so it's an environment where everybody's on the same page, if you will. And so when a whistleblower comes forward, I imagine it's the same in a corporate environment when money's the object, but it's a very repressive environment for objections. So whistleblowers who do come forward, like Snowden, are really taking their lives in their hands.
That's really true. And you put your finger on something important that I'm thinking a lot about these days and want to write something more about, which is that whistleblowers can often be anti-racist and anti-sexist, precisely because of this good old boys network you're talking about, because of crony capitalism, which is elites breaking the law to make money, where ordinary people don't have those same options. And someone like Bunny Greenhouse, whom I write about in the book, she blew the whistle on these very suspect relationships between the Bush administration and Halliburton in fighting the Iraq War. And she was retaliated against, lost her job, sued to get it reinstated, then was sort of harassed at work. And the whistleblower protection system failed her, but ultimately she filed a Title VII discrimination suit. And through that, she won a settlement.
And she was both a woman and a person of color, right?
Correct. So in some sense, whistleblowers really are breaking up old boys' networks, networks of power and prestige, in ways that the people in power think shouldn't happen. Same's true of hashtag Me Too. You can play that out as well. So they're important not only for democracy, they're also important for inclusivity.
Well, you know, you bring up the whistleblowers and how people feel about them. And certainly when we look at the hashtag Me Too movement and other places, whistleblowers and people who come forward are not always believed. And Mark 78, in fact, as you write in the book, usually not believed, or their suits or their what they're trying to allege often don't get prosecuted. So Mark 78 says, can you address the issue of whistleblower credibility? Some would have you believe that the information a whistleblower comes forward with has to be firsthand, documented, and able to stand up in a criminal trial. Yet whistleblower complaints and the subsequent inquiries are more akin to the proceedings of a grand jury, where a decision is made whether or not there is sufficient cause to issue an indictment against someone's actions. A grand jury does not decide guilt or innocence. They decide whether a criminal case can proceed or not. The standards of evidence are different. So, Professor, can you talk about that issue of whether or not whistleblowers are believed?
Yeah, I think this person has put their finger on something really important, which is that you need to it doesn't matter whether it's firsthand, secondhand. The Intelligence Committee Inspector General, who is a Trump appointee, has actually said that the process was followed properly and the law was adhered to. So it really doesn't matter where the information came from. It's the facts that have been suggested that can then be investigated. So we may never even see this whistleblower testify before Congress, but what we're already seeing is more people coming forward in a sense saying this conduct is unacceptable. And it's possible that I think it's probable that these people will testify, and that might be a way of protecting the whistleblower. But again, be very careful about the spin. That's an attempt to defend what I think is an indefensible conduct, and focus on the conduct itself. But that's at the heart of the matter.
I think you write something like only 10 or 15% of whistleblower complaints are ever then adjudicated in a way that prosecutes the person that they're blowing the whistle against. Is that right?
Yeah. And that's very important to realize, too, with this current complaint, is the fact that this Trump appointee said it should be turned over is almost miraculous, given the environment we see in Washington today and the revolving door of all these acting cabinet secretaries. Most of these complaints are explored and dismissed. And so it's significant that most this one is coming forward.
Most of the complainers are described as troublemakers, or you know, not they weren't necessarily likable people to begin with. Sometimes that's not true. But, I mean, you say by definition, whistleblowers are troublemakers because they're getting in the way of something illegal that's happening, but that people in power are taking advantage of. But often they're also seen that way or made, as our caller Peggy talked about, made to be seen that way afterwards.
That's right. That's right. I think what whistleblowers do in some ways is they force people to examine their blind spots. And we all have blind spots, but nobody likes that pointed out to them. And that's what they do. They look at a situation where everybody thinks things are just fine and it's business as usual, and they say, actually, this is not acceptable. This is wrong, and you need to change it. And that's disruptive. That takes people's time. You know, nobody wants to hear that. So there's a tendency to shoot the messenger.
So we've been talking about the fact that throughout American history, there's an ideal that people should always be speaking truth to power and that our government leaders should be working in the best interests of the people of America and of the Republic, not themselves. But often, whistleblowers are not protected. They find their livelihoods gone. Sometimes their lives are inalterably changed. And right now, we're in the midst of this situation where we have perhaps two whistleblowers. Maybe we'll see more coming forward. We don't know who they are at the moment. What should be done moving forward to, as you believe, and continue to enshrine this ideal of blowing the whistle and the protections for people who do so?
Yeah. Well, I think a big light has been shown on this influence economy, and there are measures we can take to address that once we've moved beyond the current crisis situation. We can pass more robust national security whistleblower protection. We can pass anti-corruption legislation that specifically says what is and is not acceptable for the President of the United States to do. The Constitution has the Emoluments Clause. It doesn't seem to be effective, so Congress can legislate to articulate what is and is not acceptable behavior. But it's important to keep in mind that whistleblowers are in some sense the canary in the coal mine, and if you shoot the canary, the mine may well turn deadly. So you want them to speak.
Do you think we also should do something, you write about it in the book, about the revolving door between the private sector and the public sector?
Absolutely. I mean, the thing I would say with these the mudslinging about what elites are doing, just because someone else is doing it doesn't make it right. So to me, we have to focus on what sort of behavior we want to see from our public officials. And if we don't think it's acceptable, they obviously shouldn't be profiting so extensively from private interests while in public office. That seems to be crystal clear to me. But the big question is what you do with them after they're out of office. But that's not the situation we're facing with Donald Trump. He and his family are doing it while he's in office. That's unprecedented.
That was Allison Stanger, professor of international politics and economics at Middlebury College. She's on leave from Middlebury this year, and she's a senior fellow at Harvard University's Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics. She joined Vermont Edition to talk about her very well-timed book, Whistleblowers, Honesty in America, From Washington to Trump, which came out in September, just after revelations of a whistleblower alleging improprieties or worse in a call between President Donald Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. More than 45 years ago, Richard M. Nixon, 2.5 years into his second term, became the first American president to resign. Gerald Ford, who succeeded Nixon, referred to the time before the resignation as our long national nightmare. Now, had Nixon not resigned, he almost assuredly would have been impeached. Only 3 U.S. presidents have met that fate: Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and now Donald Trump. Back in 2014, on the 40th anniversary of Nixon's resignation, Vermont Edition spoke with Kenneth Davis, author of the popular Don't Know Much About series of books, and we got a history and civics lesson on impeachment.
Thanks for having me again on a very memorable day for those of us over 40.
Yeah, I wasn't alive then, so not a memorable day for me, I'm afraid. But memorable, certainly, piece of American history. But I want to go even farther back here. So both Andrew Johnson and Bill Clinton were impeached by the House of Representatives, and then they were both later acquitted by the Senate. So explain how that process works.
Okay, it's equivalent in a sense to the indictment process in criminal trials. In other words, someone's indicted for a crime. That just means they're charged. It doesn't mean they have been proven guilty. We assume innocence in America. In the case of a president or other federal officials, including Supreme Court justices or cabinet members, the impeachment is the equivalent of an indictment. Then the trial doesn't go to a jury of one's peers, but to the Senate. This was all debated very, very carefully back in 1787 because Benjamin Franklin said, if we don't have some way to get rid of a corrupt or incompetent executive, the only choice will be assassination. So they turned to this idea, which comes from ancient British law, of impeachment, of removing a minister or a king's advisor, and they carried it over. And there was considerable debate about who should actually do the trial, who should listen to the evidence. As it turned out, they decided that the House of Representatives would have the ability to issue the articles of impeachment, the equivalent of the indictment, but that the trial would be held in the Senate. And there it would be required, while a simple majority of the House would be required to impeach, a two-thirds majority would be required to actually convict the president and then remove him from office or any other official.
Yeah, you mentioned it's not just the president. Supreme Court justices, for example, who serve for life, so there's not a great way to get rid of them other than impeachment. They can also be impeached.
That's correct. And the very first impeachment in American history was of a Supreme Court justice back in 1805. His name was Samuel Chase. It really had to do with, like all impeachments almost throughout American history, it was really much more politically motivated than a specific high crime or misdemeanor. And we can talk about that phrase, which is in the Constitution. So Samuel Chase was impeached by the House, but also acquitted in the Senate. The extraordinary moment in American history where he was tried included the fact that Aaron Burr was the sitting vice president, and so he presided over the trial. Aaron Burr, this is in 1805, had recently killed Alexander Hamilton. So imagine that scenario. The vice president kills the former secretary of the treasury in a duel and then goes down to back to Washington to sit on the first impeachment trial in American history. Truth is far stranger than fiction.
Ken, what did Andrew Johnson do that led to his impeachment in 1868?
Once again, a very political controversy. Andrew Johnson, of course, had succeeded Abraham Lincoln. He had been his vice president and became president when Lincoln was assassinated. He had removed from the cabinet the war secretary, Lincoln's war secretary, and the Senate, which was very powerful at the time, especially a group of senators known as the Radical Republicans, were not happy with Andrew Johnson's decision to do that, nor were they happy with the way he was handling the presidency. They thought he was being far too accommodating of the southern states. These were the senators who really wanted to punish the former Confederacy. So there were 11 charges leveled against Andrew Johnson, 11 articles of impeachment. He was acquitted on all of them by a single vote. It was very, very close. Once again, as Gerald Ford said in 1970 when they were considering the impeachment of William O. Douglas, another Supreme Court justice, impeachment is whatever a majority of the House of Representatives decides it is at a given moment in history. The phrase in the Constitution is that officials can be impeached for bribery, treason. Those are fairly self-explanatory, and other high crimes and misdemeanors. And that's where the rub is, because nobody's really ever defined what that means specifically, and the founders left an awful lot of wiggle room with that. The framers of the Constitution left a lot of wiggle room with that phrase, high crimes and misdemeanors.
Just briefly, because I think actually most of us who are listening were alive for Bill Clinton's impeachment. What were his high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, this again related to a policy decision or an actual crime as president, but it related to Bill Clinton's deposition given in a civil suit related to one of the women who had made claims against him. Clinton had given a deposition, and it turned out later that he had, in fact, perjured himself during that deposition. This was considered enough by the Republican House to issue two articles of impeachment. Clinton was, of course, acquitted in the Senate trial by fairly comfortable and bipartisan margins on both counts. A lot of debate at the time whether perjury in a civil case really rose to the level of the high crimes and misdemeanors that the framers of the Constitution were talking about. And many of those who voted against, voted to acquit Bill Clinton, that was part of their justification, that this was not an issue that should rise to the level of impeachment, which is the most power that the Congress has over the president. Of course, the framers of the Constitution were very concerned with balance of power and checks and balances, but this is the ultimate power that Congress has over a president, to actually overrule the decision of the will of the people in electing the president by removing him.
Well, and you know, here we are 40 years to the day from Richard Nixon's resignation, which he would have faced impeachment but didn't because he resigned. And there's been some swirling talk lately about the potential impeachment of President Obama. No one's claiming that. Democrats say House Republicans are considering it. House Republicans say the Democrats are making that up to stir up drama. So just, I mean,
and
I guess.
Fun.
Right, exactly. You know, I guess a yes or no here, Kenneth Davis. Is this still a valuable tool, impeachment?
Oh, I think it's ultimately a valuable tool, because Benjamin Franklin was right. If we didn't have any other way to get rid of a president who was truly corrupt or incompetent, I suppose, is a different question, we'd be left with assassination. Richard Nixon, by the way, there were four articles of impeachment drawn up against him. They had been voted by the House Judiciary Committee. A delegation of Republicans went to him and said, your congressional support is gone. And that was the moment at which he decided to resign instead of facing impeachment. Although there were people, you know, including his family, who said he should fight on. And of course, that's 40 years ago, the first and to date only resignation of a president.
Kenneth Davis, I really appreciate you teaching us a little bit about impeachment, because it's one of those things that swirls around and we don't always know so much about it. So thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Jane. Always a pleasure. Bye-bye.
That was Kenneth C. Davis, author of the popular Don't Know Much About book series, giving us an impeachment history lesson back in 2014 when we marked the anniversary of Richard Nixon's resignation, which he did to avoid impeachment. That's it for today. Now, tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we expect to have a live show once again, no impeachment proceedings to interrupt us on Thursday. In his State of the State address, Governor Phil Scott outlined his 2020 legislative agenda, including a call for a universal K-12 after-school network across the state. Tomorrow, we'll look at what a network like this might look like, including an Icelandic model that's been picked up here in the U.S., and what it might cost to create one in Vermont. The governor said he thinks we can do it without raising taxes. Can we? Send your questions and comments to vermontedition@vpr.org and listen live tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is directed by James Stewart, Jake Rusnak, and Mary Carol Magazzini. Our production team includes managing producer Lydia Brown and producer Matthew Smith, with support from Anna St. Marie. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Have a good night, and thanks for listening.